The next case for argument is 14-3101 Archuleta v. Miller. All right, now settle. Mr. Blaze.
May it please the court.
Blaze, let me ask you. Page 14 of the government's brief, okay? You say, to be clear, we do not challenge the board's right to abandon the burden-shifting approach to considering evidence outlined in Ketterer. I read that with a small degree of surprise. In the Frey case, specifically at 359 Fed 3rd 1360, we said, referring to Ketterer, we endorse the board's approach in these cases as set forth above and adopt it as the law of the circuit. Now that says to me that the Ketterer burden-shifting approach is the law, and the board is not in a position to overrule us. The only way that the Ketterer rule can be changed now is by either this court taking Frey in bank or by the Supreme Court overruling us. So I was a little surprised that you sort of, the government comes into this case with one hand tied behind its back. Why does the government concede that the board can overrule Frey?
What we were trying to express was that the necessity of presenting evidence would remain the same, but that it wasn't necessarily the mechanical process.
But we said a two-step process. I remember the case.
Yes, sir.
And we said, okay, the board's got it right. This is a good approach. We adopt it as the law of the circuit. Okay? And the board can't change that.
So
only this court in bank or the Supreme Court. Senator, do you see what we're saying?
Yes, sir. Perhaps more fundamentally, for the purposes of our appeal, the point was that was not what we were appealing. Maybe we could have.
So you agree that the board was wrong here, leaving aside, we'll get to the merits, you agree the board was wrong here to jettison the burden-shifting approach?
Yes. I believe Frey actually controls.
So you sort of back off a little bit from that statement in the brief.
So, to the extent that, as I said, what we were trying to make clear was that was not the error.
But it's an important part of the case, because it's a very different case when you look at it through the burden-shifting approach that was in Ketterer and Frey and followed by this court in Weiser. Very different case because of what the AJ found in terms of findings of fact and credibility. It's a very different case when you go through the burden-shifting approach than when you look at it the way the board did, putting all these general factors together. So in other words, you agree that the board erred here in backing off or trying to change Frey?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
But specifically, that wasn't the point we appealed, and I'm sure we will discuss further.
But it's a critical point. So you say the board was wrong on that?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And before I start the actual substance of my argument, just a quick house cleaning matter I'd like to point out. On page 2 of our brief, our opening brief, we cited to JA 96 and quoted some language from that position description. I realized in preparing for the argument that that's actually a position description from the Fish and Wildlife Service, which happens to be in the record. It's not the actual position description that we're dealing with here. That position description is at JA 166. I'm not sure it will affect the argument any, but I did want to note that error in our brief. So the decision of the Merit Systems Protection Board should be reversed because it turns settled civil service law on its head and undermines personnel management throughout the entire government. The board...
Who else? How many people were considered for that liaison job?
As far as I know, specifically just Ms. Miller.
Well, what do you mean, other than specifically?
Well, as far as I know, there's nothing in the record that talks further than that, but there's also no indication that as they were working on creating this new position, that they didn't consider all of the people in the region in order to think about
Wasn't it indicative that the person who drafted the position was instructed to change it, to change the GS position?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because when the position was created, the creation of the position was in response to policy directives from the Secretary. And in creating the position, a determination was made that it should be graded as a GS-13. There's no indication that I found that the reason it should be graded as a GS-13 was because they wanted Ms. Miller. All indications are is that as management considered...
The analysis, as I recall from the record, was this isn't a GS-13 position.
Creating position descriptions is an iterative process, and if management decides it wants to create a position at the GS-13 level, and the people who actually have to write up the position description are having trouble justifying, then they'll go back to management and say, okay, I need some more responsibilities, or I need some more something, so that if you want it to be a 13, you need to give me more.
So the more that was given, Ms. Miller didn't meet those qualifications, did she?
Yes, she did, Your Honor.
She had a doctorate? What was it, advanced degree? What did the record call for?
I don't recall that she needed a doctorate.
Well, she needed qualifications she didn't have.
Well,
and if you want to argue with me on that, I'll find the specifics. You go ahead and I'll find it for you.
Well, let me ask you a more global question, which is, what is the government's view as to how the board erred here?
The board erred in two fundamental ways. One, it conflated its consideration of the reassignment itself, which is a non-appealable action, not subject to board review for the efficiency of the service or
Well, I don't know. Is that the government's view? I mean, there's several alternatives going on here. I mean, as I read it, and the board can tell me if I'm reading it wrong, they first said this wasn't necessary. And then in reconsideration, they seem to have backed away from the necessary standard and moved towards, at least using the words, legitimate or bona fide. Is it your view that that's the correct standard? At least you may quibble over how they applied it. But is there a standard the agency does have to establish that it was a bona fide or legitimate reassignment?
Yes. As a general proposition, any management directive, geographic relocation, whatever, any management directive should be at least on its face lawful.
Okay. And your view is that the board gets to review that?
No. It gets to at least examine whether it was lawful, and in the case of a reassignment, whether it was made in good faith for legitimate management reasons.
So your dispute with the board here is that notwithstanding that they said that they were using the standard the second time around, that indeed, if you examine the facts and the criteria they used, they went beyond that, right?
Yes, ma'am.
How does that part of it, the efficiency of the service, move into what you think the correct criteria is? I think in Frey, we did use the term the efficiency of the service in connection with legitimacy.
The court did, and I will say that in a variety of board decisions and decisions from this court, there's language to the effect of sometimes it just says a bona fide, legitimate managerial discretion exercise and just stops. Sometimes it says to promote the efficiency of the service,
in the
interest of the service, for the good of the service, and indeed in the record here when the managers, Mr. Knox and Ms. Massacre, talk about their management decision to reassign. They talk about that they believed this reassignment would be good for the service, that it would promote the mission of the agency in Alaska, which is, of course, a fundamental managerial responsibility, is to use your personnel, their talent, skills, and experience where you think...
So what do you want us to do? I mean, we review for substantial evidence. So even though the board, at least in reconsideration, applies in name at least the standard that you're saying is the correct standard, then what are we to do to say that even though they applied the correct standard, if we review the facts ourselves, we conclude that there was not sufficient evidence?
So,
what do you want to do?
You touched on it before. They state the standard, they misapply the standard. The only adverse action that's before the board for review for efficiency of the service is the removal. There's long-standing case law, Fry was mentioned, there's others, at both the board and this court that recognizes that when an employee refuses to follow management directive...
No, but even you're not coming here saying that that's the extent of their review and they can't look at the underlying action at all.
No, but they look at the underlying action only to determine whether it was made in good faith for legitimate management reasons. They do not look at it for the wisdom of it, whether they got it right or wrong.
So let me apologize to you, Mr. Blades. I put doctor on my mind because what the requirement was as they expanded the position was that the person had to have carried out groundbreaking work in this area. And I shortened that to a doctorate.
Doctor.
But she did. Ms. Miller, your expert or witness Stewart testified that Ms. Miller had never carried out any such groundbreaking work.
I would say to dovetail with Judge Pro's question, I really
it does dovetail because
right,
I think it screams pretext.
Right, although the board's decision is not supported by substantial evidence, that's what we think is more fundamentally wrong is the board's application of the standard. But as to the evidence, the administrative judge considered all of the evidence, made credibility determinations, and determined, among other things, that Ms. Miller was qualified for the position. The testimony of the experts. She heard the testimony of everyone else. Ms. Miller, at the time that the position was first presented, apparently considered herself qualified for the position.
She offered to do it long distance.
She even tried to see if she could get it upgraded to a GS-14. So, to the extent that's a factual question, whether she was qualified, that was resolved by the administrative judge, and the board itself, with regard to that and the other factual findings of the administrative judge, did not make any contrary findings or explain any contrary findings. And back to Judge Crook's question, the board essentially didn't do any analysis based on what the facts in the record were. They went through the process of stating the standards and then just reaching the conclusion that the reassignment was not bona fide or for legitimate management reasons, where the record is full of evidence as to the good faith of the managers and the reasons for why they were making the reassignment. The board otherwise acknowledges that the agency had a good reason for creating the position in Anchorage and for believing that Ms. Miller was well-suited to accept the position. But nevertheless, the board simply concludes, as I say, without any real analysis, just citing the standard, and then says that because, essentially, they think it wasn't a good idea to ask Ms. Miller to take the position, and that once she refused, the agency then had to fill two vacant positions, that it couldn't have been bona fide or for legitimate management reasons.
Well,
why don't we say that we view the rebuttal while we restore a couple minutes and let's hear from the other side.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The board simply...
The board doesn't have to follow Frye, right?
The board does have to follow Frye. And Frye says at the bottom of page 1357, where a removal action is based on a refusal to accept a directed geographical reassignment, the agency must prove by a preponderance of the evidence that its reassignment decision was bona fide and based upon legitimate management considerations in the interest of the service. Right. So here the board's simple holding is...
You're representing the board?
Yes.
Mr. Godger, right?
That's correct.
But what about we said at 1360, Mr. Godger, we discussed Ketterer at length, and we said we endorsed the board's approach in these cases as set forth above and adopted as the law of the circuit. And that means we specifically said, I remember the case, and I remember it being argued to us, this is a good approach. Okay? So we looked at the case, we agreed, and we said we adopt that as the law of the circuit. Now, once it's the law of the circuit, the board can't back off from it or change it. Okay? We can do that in bank, or the Supreme Court can do it to us. And the one thing I would disagree with, there's references in the board opinion to us deferring to the board in Ketterer, in Frey. We didn't defer. We said, you've got a good approach here. It's now the law of the circuit. Okay? So let's go back to the two-step approach. That's what controls here. The board can't change that, as Mr. Blades came around and agreed.
Well, the board.
Do you agree that the board can't overrule us?
The board's view, and you're correct, it's at the bottom of the appendix, page 13, is citing Tunick, that where an agency interpretation is found to be reasonable, then another panel can actually.
But who's the other panel here? The board?
No, it would be this court.
But we, yeah,
it's not right. Bound by the earlier, as far, and to be clear, what we're talking about is the burden of production.
But we said we approve and adopt as the law of the circuit the burden of production approach that was stated in Ketterer. So that means it's the law now, okay? So the board has to follow the two-step approach that we laid out in Frey when we followed Ketterer.
Even if that was an error, I believe it would be a harmless error here because the
How
burden
is it
of
harmless
proof,
when the board purports to overrule us?
Well, the burden
that seems
of,
like a pretty big thing.
Right, even as Frey makes clear, and I read that section, the burden of proof always remains on the agency.
Yeah, but you have to go through a two-step approach, and it becomes a very different case when you do that here because the AJ found, number one, that Mr. Knox was credible, and that there was a legitimate reason for the removal, point one. Point two, it was Judge Lunell Taylor, she found that that Ms. Miller was qualified for the position, and she found her not credible on certain points. And finally, she rejected the various affirmative defenses. Now the board, in the footnote, the first opinion, 15-513 opinion, doesn't change any of that. It doesn't disturb the finding that it was a legitimate management reason, and it doesn't disturb the finding that she was qualified, and it specifically says we agree with the AJ on the affirmative defenses. So there, under the two-step Ketterer approach, which controls, we agree now, the board has... The government has made out a prima facie case, and it's the other side's burden to come in and show differently, and it didn't.
Well, even
and the board puts in these things about there wasn't a vacancy in the position. None of that's relevant.
Even if Ketterer, the burden of production was applied here, we'd end up with the same result because there needs
How?
To be.
You can't get around the findings. There's no challenge here to the findings, the credibility determinations of the AJ. No one has said the AJ failed to follow the proper Hillen approach.
The problem with the agency testimony isn't that it lacks credibility, it's that it's conclusory.
Can I take you a step back a little bit, looking at the evidence? I'm not clear on how things went down here. The board initially, I'm saying this and I want you to tell me whether I'm right or wrong. Okay. The board initially uses the standard of it wasn't necessary repeatedly in its opinion. And then it comes in for reconsideration. Does the board kind of get told and appreciate that necessary is the wrong standard, so we've got to change that and we've got to apply a legitimate standard? Is that a fair assessment of what went on here? Not in terms of burden of proof. I'm talking about whether you apply necessary, which the board repeatedly applied initially, or whether the standard is legitimate.
So OPM came in at the board level, asked for reconsideration at the board level, and argued that necessary was the incorrect language.
Right.
And the board basically agreed. That is, that the correct language is out of the statute.
So the board agreed that its initial analysis was incorrect because it applied the wrong standard. A too high a standard of necessary versus legitimate, correct?
Right, but they reach the same result.
Yeah, I know. And then they go back, and I'm not seeing, except for the words, it's just hard for me. They repeat a lot, and so in their reconsideration, they repeat a lot about what they said before about necessary, using necessary again. And then they cite a few cases, and they talk about burden shifting. And so where would you say is the board's the chunk of the board's analysis as to why this was not a legitimate board action? Is it at page 11 where they start?
Well, as the board says, I would point to both page 7 in the reconsideration decision and probably in the first decision, 30 to 31, but page 7.
Okay.
Where is that in the appendix, Mr. Gunn?
Appendix at page 7, sorry.
Okay.
And this is the agency, just so the record will be clear, this is
right.
The December 6, 2013.
Exactly. In sum, the agency failed to present any evidence showing that its reasons for directing...
I'm on page 7, but I'm not seeing where you're reading.
It's the paragraph 11, it's marked as paragraph 11. It begins the board end of discussion, however,
yes.
Stating that in sum, the agency failed to present any evidence showing that its reasons for directing... the appellate geographic reassignment to Anchorage was bona fide, and goes on from there. And then it says, the emphasis in this case has always been on the agency's failure to show that its reasons for the reassignment were bona fide, and that its action promoted the efficiency of the service. So the problem in this case isn't the witness testimony, which was conclusory. They just say she's the best person. The problem with this case is if you look at the actual position description, the position they're trying to put her in, and you look at the requirements, okay, and then going back to Frye or Frey, where the court says this has to be a legitimate management reason. Well, the board can only sustain an agency action based on the reason provided by the agency. It can't come sustain it on some other reason, some alternative reason. It has to be the reason provided by the agency.
But the agency found it was legitimate, that legitimate reasons have been established, and the board did not say that fact-finding was wrong.
So the reason that provided by the agency...
But the board then comes in with all of these things about, you know, her position wasn't being eliminated, she had good performance reviews and all of this, and a whole bunch of things, and then said this was a veiled removal. This was a veil for removal action. There's no basis for that. In terms of the findings that were found, it's contrary to what the AJ found, and the board did not say, we reject the AJ's findings. It just went off and brought in a whole lot of other things.
The problem here is not the evidence, it's the absence of evidence. So the reason given by the Park Service for this reassignment was she's uniquely qualified for this position. She's the only person who meets all the requirements of the position. And you look at the requirements on page 169 to 170 of the position description. Requirements for this position. Expert knowledge of federal laws and regulations at a Alaskan Indian law at a mastery level. Expert knowledge at a mastery level of cultural traditions and sacred beliefs of the tribes. Extremely sensitive to...
Do they have to prove that this was the only person in the whole government that was qualified for the position in order to effectuate a reassignment based on legitimate reasons?
They have to prove the reason they give, and the reason they gave was that she was the only one who met all the needs of the position. Now, if that was the reason they gave, that's what they have to prove.
Can I, just before your time runs out, something that would disturb me, and maybe I'm just missing something about what cases say that I'm not familiar with. It seemed to me that the board didn't rely exclusively, but relied heavily on the fact that this was a valuable and successful employee, and her leaving created two vacancies. Is that a fair statement?
That is, yes.
Are there other cases that rely on that? My concern with that is, firstly, it's a temporal thing because you don't know that in most cases. But, you know, the government fired 15,000 air traffic controllers. It created an absolute mess in the flying skies of America. And I don't recall anybody ever using a factor, well, my God, we've created 15,000 vacancies by firing these people. I've just never seen it used. By definition, anytime you fire someone, you could fire 10 people for misconduct, and you could be at a hiring freeze, so that's impossible to ever even fill those positions in the foreseeable future. Is the board going to use as a criteria that it didn't promote the efficiency of the service because now you've got vacancies and you can't fill them?
No. To be clear, and to be clear, successful employees are reassigned all the time, and the most common, most typical type of reassignment is a reorganization or a restructuring or reduction in force by an agency to make itself more efficient.
Sure, and if this woman had accepted the job, then there wouldn't be a vacancy. But because she refused to accept the job, the agency removed her, right?
Well,
and the board doesn't deny
different?
That agencies are allowed to do that as long as the reassignment was for a legitimate reason, right?
Right.
So in every case where somebody is reassigned, doesn't want to take the reassignment, and then leaves, is there going to be a thumb on the scale that this is a factor that says it doesn't promote the efficiency of the service because we lost a good employee, a decent employee, and now we've got two vacancies?
No, not at all. And again, this happens frequently that you have reassignments as part of a reduction in force.
So to what extent the board repeatedly referred to this as a criteria? Am I wrong about that, that the board relied on this?
What the board is trying to point out is how unusual this case actually is. You have someone singled out and at the hearing just prays for her about how wonderful she's doing as a park superintendent. And she's the only one here being reassigned. Even in Fry, there were, I think, four other people being reassigned. It wasn't just Frey being singled out for this. And she's doing really great in the position, and they want her to put her in another position, but there's no evidence showing that she meets the qualifications or she's uniquely qualified to use the reason provided by the Park Service.
Well, she's unqualified according to their own standards.
She doesn't meet the requirements listed here. But in any event, the reason provided was she's uniquely qualified, which is something somewhere above minimally qualified. So it doesn't make sense, and it's hard to see how it could promote the efficiency of the service to take someone who's doing so well in their current position, take them out of that, create a vacancy, put them in another position where we don't know how she'll perform based on the record, which doesn't show she's qualified. That's what I think the board is trying to show how unusual this case is. If you look at other cases, Fry's a good example. Fry was not performing well in his position, and so the organization that he was a part of was trying to make itself more efficient by moving
Roger,
people
let me
around.
Ask you, the board, I think it was in the 513 decision, uses the term, this reassignment was a veil for a removal. Do you recall that? That's a very sinister characterization. This woman had a good record there. There's no indication of bad relations with Mr. Knox. As has been pointed out, she was successful. There's no indications of friction or tension. But why is this sinister, hostile implication brought in with no factual basis for it? She didn't even testify that she'd been harassed or anything.
Well, there's circumstantial evidence that this was a veil to affect an adverse action. Specifically, the creative position at the GS-13 level, her level, came back and the classifier said this is...
No, but what's the evidence? But what's the evidence of any hostile... Often in these cases, we'll see some kind of a background of hostility, tension, that's not in the record here. And yet the board puts this sinister term in there.
I don't think it was meant to be sinister.
Wasn't there some evidence of her speaking out of turn in some fashion?
There's evidence in both the proposal notice and the removal decision that there were tensions between her and her staff or that there was poor morale. All of that's forgotten when this case comes to the hearing. Suddenly she is the best superintendent ever, and you read it, and I quote big chunks of it in our brief.
I'm going to have to go back to the record, but I recall that there appeared to be a reason for the creation of the position, a pretextual reason. That is,
that she did something that angered the people up in Anchorage. What was it?
Well, there was, and Mr. Passman might have more on this, but there was a management review that happened right before this position was created. The Park Service, for whatever reason, did not put that in the record. So, I mean, that would be that could have been a legitimate reason to, if she did have performance problems, but that's not what they're saying. They're saying she doesn't have performance problems. She has a high level of performance in her current position.
She spoke out in some fashion. I'll let your co-counsel.
Why don't we hear from Mr. Passman, and we're going to shrink your time to a couple minutes, Mr. Passman, because we're way out.
May it please the court. OPM is really objecting to the board's weighing of the evidence in regard to the reasons set forth by the agency for the directed assignment. Yet, OPM is conceding that the board must review the legitimacy of any supervisory order before sustaining discipline based upon the failure to obey the order. It is necessary for the board to review the rationale for the geographic reassignment here to determine whether the employee has shown that the reassignment had no solid or substantial basis in personnel.
Can you just address very briefly, because you've got very little time, but Judge Shaw's point about whether or not the board had the authority to overrule Frey?
Well, I think that was better handled by the board representative, but I think still the bottom line is that the agency has the burden of proof, similar to an adverse action, by preponderance of the evidence. They didn't show that here. What we really have here was a disguised adverse action.
Well, except we've got an AJ opinion that credited, that had testimony, lots of testimony, that credited the testimony.
Right.
And if you just take that as a given, and she had an opportunity to hear from the appellant as well, why isn't that sufficient to establish legitimacy?
It isn't because, for example, in these type of situations, when a new position is created, it's required that somebody from HR review the employee to determine whether she meets the minimum qualifications. That was never done here. There's no evidence in the record that
there
was any...
Were you representing this person at the trial, at the hearing?
I was.
Yeah. So you had an opportunity... Did any of that come out at the hearing? You had an opportunity to cross-examine these individuals?
Well, we didn't, because the agency never put on any HR witnesses. They only put on an individual who was from another agency who was not involved in the process of qualifying Ms. Miller. It only came out during discovery how the agency had engineered the position to be a GS-13 and had created it for reassignment. That's really unusual. When positions are created, they're created for recruitment. Then people apply. People can also apply for reassignment. But this position was specifically engineered for Ms. Miller. And when the classifier said the job wouldn't even barely classify as a 12, they raised the position then to a GS-13 by putting in all these very tough requirements that Ms. Miller couldn't meet. She was an engineer and manager.
Oh, sir, go ahead.
Let me ask you this. As I was asking your co-counsel, I seem to recall that there was an event which triggered this creation of this position, and that it was something that, at least you argue, Ms. Miller did, that irritated the folks up in Anchorage. What was that?
Well, I
know I saw it in there.
Yes. There was a management review. Counselor pointed out is not part of the record, but it's referenced also in the meeting that Ms. Miller had with when she learned about her reassignment, and it's also mentioned in the proposal and the deciding in the decision letter. And the management review basically claimed that Ms. Miller was having friction with staff at the park, and then she brought that up during that meeting on April 27th. But even there, she had no prior warning of any possible reassignment. Nobody had counseled her. All of a sudden, she brought
in
a meeting.
Excuse me, I don't want to interrupt, but one question that I had, just there's reference in here, and what is exactly a mobility agreement, and how does it work, and what is the significance in this case? The briefs on both sides were written like we knew what that was, but I didn't see an explanation of what exactly is that.
Mobility agreement is in positions that are required to move around the country to get different experience. Typically, like SES positions have mobility agreements. Often, law enforcement.
The employee says, "I agree to move to Kansas City or Denver if I'm sent there."
They know, they agree to move as required by the agency to enhance their training and experience. And there's no such example here. But Mr. Miller was brought in without any notice on April 27, 2010, and told, we're going to offer you a voluntary reassignment to Anchorage, which is a long distance away. She said, I need some time to think about it. They said, we'll give you 2 hours. 2 hours later, they come back in the afternoon, and Ms. Miller tells them she's not likely to accept the reassignment. She doesn't want it. And all of a sudden, they give her a letter then saying, you're directed to be reassigned to Anchorage, and if you don't accept it, you're going to be fired in 30 days. No indication about due process or anything. Now, later, the letter was withdrawn, but it shows the mindset that they had already planned to remove Ms. Miller, and this is more of a disguised adverse action. She was never well-suited for the position. There's no evidence in the record, nor did the board ever find that she was well-suited for the position. And the agency...
But what about the AJ's findings?
The AJ's findings were erroneous. She ignored all of the contrary documentary evidence. She didn't discuss any of the documentary evidence.
But the board didn't disturb those findings.
Well, the board found that Ms. Miller, they didn't go into any detail, and they could have done a lot more, but they found that Ms. Miller submitted credible evidence to cast doubt on the agency's motivation in affecting her removal. And it's right in the board decision. Now, they could have gone further and said what the credible evidence was, but it's the very evidence that we're discussing here today, that she was not qualified for the position.
Okay. Thank you. No, we've gone way over, so if you need extra, with the other side, so if you need extra time, we can give it to you, but I'm not sure how many more questions there are.
Thank you, Your Honor. Quick point, as we were talking about before, as a matter of law, once the agency has established that they, in good faith, for legitimate reasons, had made the reassignment position.
Yeah, but we're talking here about all this evidence in the record that apparently, at least arguably, points in the opposite direction.
And the only fact-finding that's been done has not been overturned by the board or explained that any contrary finding should be found, and that's the findings of the administrative judge that the agency did have legitimate management reasons for making the reassignment. There's been much made of the idea that the agency was saying, well, she's uniquely qualified. As was mentioned, that didn't mean that she was the only person in the entire world who could do this. And perhaps it was hyperbole on the part of the manager. But what they were stating, and their testimony reveals this, is that among the people within the Alaska region, they believed that she was the person who could best do this job. Now, there's been mention about the management review. The management review was kind of a typical periodic management assessment that looked at all of the parks throughout the Alaska region and basically said, how are we doing? Where can we do better? And the review made some suggested improvements. The most you can take out of that is that Ms. Miller, just like everybody else, was not perfect. And Ms. Miller herself, and perhaps this is what Judge Wallach's been thinking of, Ms. Miller herself took some issue with the way the management review had been conducted. But in the decision sustaining her removal by Ms. Massica, she mentions the management review. She makes reference to some of the findings. And as been mentioned, the review itself is not actually in the record. But she also says that the sole reason she was being removed was because she refused to accept the directed reassignment. And otherwise, there really is no evidence that the agency, in advance of creating this position and deciding that Ms. Miller, among the current employees, would be best to fill it, had any other designs on taking any personnel action against Ms. Miller. They recognized that, as I mentioned, she might not have been perfect as a superintendent, but one of her obvious manifested skill sets was that she was good at developing relations, particularly with the local community and the tribes, and that's what this position was going to be all about, but it was going to be bigger than just at Sitka. It was going to be throughout the Alaska region. and was created as a result of policy directive from the secretary himself. And so there really is no evidence that it wasn't in a good faith, legitimate reason to make the reassignment. There is no evidence that there was a pretext to make the reassignment. And the longstanding rule is that employees can be expected to follow management directive, including relocations. And if they don't, an appropriate penalty is removal. If I can have one last on the mobility agreement, mobility agreements are...
it's such an appropriate remedy that a letter was prepared in advance before she was even offered the position saying, you're going to be removed if you don't give us a decision.
The directed letter said... And I think this is fairly standard language. When management directs a reassignment, they will also inform the employee that a refusal to accept the direction of management will subject the employee to discipline up to and including removal. And that's part of giving the employee notice that this isn't really just asking.
It's the norm to call someone in and say, congratulations, you're being reassigned to a better job. And by the way, here's a letter saying you'll be fired if you don't accept this.
That's an interesting
approach to personnel management, I must say.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, I appreciate the idea that management wants to ask first to see if somebody's willing to go voluntarily. But if they really need the person or want the person, believe that they have good reason that this person will help the mission of the agency in this new assignment, management is prepared to direct the reassignment. They'll ask first. If they're refused, they'll direct the reassignment, which no one questions they have the ability to do. No one questions that an employee does not.
Of course they do. The question is, why did they prepare that letter in advance, which, by the way, they later withdrew.
I'm sorry, which, by the way,
they later withdrew.
Oh. I can't tell you. It's not in the record. I would presume other aspects of the record indicate that they were trying to expeditiously fill this position. Perhaps they had been getting pressure from above that they'd already spent more than a year on it. They needed to get it filled. But I honestly don't know, and I don't think there's anything in the record as to why, when the time came, they were moving so quickly. If I can address the mobility agreement as the last thing, mobility agreement is a generic term for agreements, kind of self-explanatory, but I understand not completely, that will control the terms if someone is asked to move. And someone is, of course, agreeing in advance that they may be asked to move. But the absence of a mobility agreement in no way restricts the employer from instructing someone to move. It's just that there are not predetermined terms as to what the movement will be. So with that, Your Honor, we respectfully request that the court reverse the decision of the board.
We thank all counsel on the cases submitted. That concludes our proceedings for this morning.
The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10:00 a.m.